You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Kara Jaimo is a former staff writer at Atlas Obscura. She's written for the New York Times, Robert Zeitung, and Bloomberg Businessweek with Christina Couch. She wrote Detector Dogs. She plays guitar in Sidebody. Her new book, co-written with Joshua Foer, is Atlas Obscura, Wildlife, and Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders, with Bookshop Santa Cruz on October 22nd at 7 p.m. She'll be hosting an event at the Loudon Nelson Community Center, where she'll be appearing, co-sponsored by the Friends of Santa Cruz State Parks. Thank you for joining me, Kara.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, when I look at this book, one of the things, I just started flipping through it, and I think I found an immediate personal connection. I think anybody who picks up this book will have a similar experience, which is 2 pages in, you had a feature on something called the gopher tortoise. And that just took me straight back to my feckless youth when, at the age of 11 or so, we moved from Northern California to Southern California, and with our house came a fabulous burrowing tortoise.
Oh, awesome.
And it was rather large, and it lived with us for the entire time we were there until we sold the house. Talk about the design of the book and the way you intend to capture the reader's attention, and how I think every reader is going to find something in this book that will speak directly to them personally.
Oh, that's awesome to hear. Yeah, that was definitely one goal when we were putting together this book. So this is the third Atlas Obscura book. There have been two before this. All of them are, like this book, very large, sort of hefty compendiums of amazing things around the world. So the first one was about places that you can visit around the world that might not appear in normal travel guides. The second one was about incredible foods from cultures all around the world that you can try. And this third one is about nature and natural wonders. So the mind-blowing species that we share our planet with, animals and plants and fungi and microbes and the environments that they call home and the relationships they have with each other. So yeah, the idea is definitely to hope that people reading will learn something new, but also, like you said, hopefully find something that they maybe already know about and care about that they can learn a little bit more about. Putting together the book was a really interesting challenge and process because it's so big, and yet it only contains a fraction of what there is on the planet, you know, like we couldn't possibly fit everything in. Also, sorry, you might hear, I have some animals with me here. My cats are here. They're wanting to participate in this conversation. Can be a little bit loud.
Yeah, my pugs are snoring away in the other room, so we're safe.
That's good. But yeah, so every single chapter, really the idea was that you could flip through and every single page would have something different and surprising that you didn't expect, even if you had just read the page before. So just trying to include a diversity of things, like ranging from what types of creatures we're including, like birds, insects, microbes, fungi, to where they're found. So different ones are found all across the world. And also what makes them so special, or what we decided to focus on for their little entry in the book. So some are fascinating. Like you said, the burrowing tortoises, they have this cool thing that they do that makes room for other creatures to live. So gopher tortoises, they dig these deep burrows and then other creatures kind of move in. So you might have small mammals living in these burrows. You might have like bugs eating the dirt and detritus that gets thrown up when the tortoises are digging. They kind of create, we call them like hoteliers in the book, because they create this place for all these other creatures to live. Or you might have an animal that's interesting because of its connection to human history and culture, or its own special evolutionary history. So somebody described the book as feeling sort of like a box of chocolates. Like you're flipping through and you're never sure whether the next one you're going to get is going to be this flavor or this flavor, but like hopefully it's going to be tasty and good no matter what it is. So that's definitely the feeling we were going for.
That's exactly what it's like. And I want to just ratchet back a bit and talk about Atlas Obscura, which may be an obscure term to some of us who haven't been on the web. It was founded, you guys are whippersnappers only since 2009. Talk about the founders and your co-author, Joshua Foer. That last name is familiar, might be familiar to many people. He's the brother of Jonathan Safran Foer, who is well noted for as a novelist, and his novel Everything is Illuminated about the post 9/11 New York was made into a movie. Talk about the creation of Atlas Obscura.
Sure. So, Atlas Obscura, like you said, was founded about 15 years ago. And the idea, I mean, I don't, just to speak for the co-founders, I was not one of them. It was Josh and Dylan Thuris co-founded the company. But the idea, I think, was to kind of like, in the 2000s, the internet was becoming such a huge thing, and it was doing two different things. It was like connecting people and allowing access to information that maybe people couldn't access before, but it was also maybe making the world feel a little bit small and making it feel like the outside world could be contained in a computer. Like, was there anything new to learn? Was there anything like fresh to discover? So I think Atlas Obscura was founded to sort of like use the internet to actually make the outside world that you can actually be in seem even bigger. So it started as a website that collected interesting places. So if you went to the website, you would find this, you still will find this online encyclopedia of cool places, like ranging from around the corner from wherever you are to across the world. And you can kind of explore, and you can use it to explore in real life. So if you're traveling, you can use it as a guide to find these kind of like hidden places that might not appear in a normal tour guide, or you might, or a different tour guide, or you might not hear about from people who have visited before. Or you can like just use it to explore from your desk chair. Like, if you're bored and you have a few minutes in between tasks, you can go over to Atlas Obscura and you'll probably learn about something you never knew about before. So it's expanded. In addition to being an online atlas, there are, books now. This is the third book. There are events that get held across the country, across the world, where people, share an experience together or talk about something interesting that they know about. There are online courses where you can learn about things like taxidermy or like astronomy or making dyes out of plants, like kind of anything you can think of. There are trips. I'm actually co-leading two trips to the Galapagos next year through Atlas Obscura. We're going to be
Wow,
talking a
that
lot.
sounds like fun.
Yeah, I think it'll be great. We're going to be talking about how that place really helped us understand evolution and is home to so many really unique creatures. But yeah, there's the whole point of all of it is to just help people engage with the world with a sense of curiosity and wonder, and help remember that, like, even though we might feel a little bit jaded, like some of the time from things going on in the world or just feeling like there's nothing new, there really is so much to discover out there. So that's the point of the company, as far as I can tell.
Well, one of the things I like about this book and books like this is, everything it focuses on is something beautiful, interesting, different. This book is suffused with a kind of positivity. When you look at this, you're looking at a book about life and not just life, really weird stuff and fun stuff. And once again, to emphasize the personal connection I think anybody will have with this book, when I glance at the cover, there's a picture of a lizard. It's a variety of Jackson's chameleon, which back in yet another era of my feckless youth as a college kid, I had two of these as pets, and they were wonderful pets. They would just hang out on, the curtains up and of the house. So talk about how this book has a lot of contributors. How much of this book, how did you put this together? I mean, was this just like reading through sheets of paper, looking at all these wonderful pictures? How did you wrap your brain to like come out with a product instead of just like, surrounding yourselves with a thousand stacks of papers in your house until you could not escape?
Totally, totally. So yeah, like you said, the book, I was lucky enough to work with a ton of contributors. I think over 100 people contributed pieces to this book. I knew when I signed on to this project that there was no way that A, I was going to be able to write the whole thing on my own because I knew it was going to be a big book. And B, I knew that I didn't really know enough myself personally, despite my interest and experience with this topic. I knew there were tons of really amazing species that I had probably never heard of before. So what I decided to do was send out some. I'm a science journalist. Like, I've met a lot of people in my work over the years, and there are luckily a number of conduits to kind of like ask for pitches from people. So I sent out calls for pitches for each chapter. There are 7 chapters, and I got pitches from writers from all over the world. And a lot of them, like you were saying, have these really moving and exciting personal connections to what they're writing about. So somebody might be writing about, a sea turtle that lives in their part of India that they've seen coming up on the beach to lay eggs before, and they know somebody who does really important conservation work. Like that's a real example from the book. Somebody interviewed a radio DJ who works for an environmental radio station in India that's like specifically is trying to help sea life, including turtles. And it's a fishing community, so this radio station spreads information about local wildlife so that people in the fishing community can learn about them and everybody can work together to protect them. So that's one example. A contributor wrote about that. But just all kinds of really incredible people ended up pitching. And so then, I had, like you said, like metaphorically, digitally, stacks and stacks of pitches. I'd have my own ideas of creatures that I'd encountered in writing over the years. And I would kind of just I made a big spreadsheet. I have a lot of spreadsheets and just sort of said, like, okay, like here's, what creature can appear here that this would probably go well after this. And it's organized. The chapters are all biomes. So you have forests followed by grasslands, mountains, deserts, oceans, cities, and islands. And then within the chapters, it's geographical. So you kind of move around the world geographically within that environment. So we had those two organizing structures. And then within that, I really just tried to make it so that every page was surprising. So like if you had, a primate on one page, I wanted there to be a bird on the next page, and then a fish on the next page, and then a plant, just sort of have it be like a real diversity presented in an exciting way. But yeah, working with the contributors was awesome. I met so many people, and it was great to have people write about these creatures that they knew so well.
It must have been a really fun community. Did you ever have like group Zooms, the sessions where you would have like 18 different contributors talking at once?
I wish we should have done something like that. It was pretty one-on-one, like in terms of the relationships. Like I was writing a lot of this, by myself and then editing one-on-one with individual contributors. But now that the book is out in the world, we've been able to celebrate together. We had a fun virtual book launch event that a lot of contributors came to. And as I've been going from city to city, I've gotten to meet some of the people who did some of the writing, which has been really great.
Long ago, before even I think there was an Atlas Obscura, I was reviewing books and on the internet and talking to authors and publishers. And I remember Workman Publishing; they were publishing very small books that were really beautifully done, but they were, small. And this is a whole, a couple of light years beyond that. And it reminds me of some of the work from DK Publishing. So talk about, telling your publisher, well, we're going to do this book. It's going to have about 600 pages. Everyone is going to be in four colors, heavy stock. We'll have multiple photographs. How did your publisher react to this? And it seems like they would have to be a really important partner in the process of turning this into a book.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that was really fun for me. This is my second book, but it was definitely a much bigger undertaking than my first book, which was shorter. And working with the publisher and the designer, and there's two great illustrators who worked on this book. Zoe Keller did the cover illustration of the chameleon and some of the internal chapter opener illustrations, and then Iris Gottlieb did spot illustrations within. It was great to work with both of them. The designer was fantastic. And yeah, the publisher worked really hard to find a lot of great photos We did a lot of back and forth making sure that the photos were of the correct species because that can be really tricky. So
I
it was a ton of
imagine so. I never thought about
yeah.
that, but yeah, gosh, that must be really tough to nail down in a nonfiction book. You want it all to be right.
Yeah,
And when you're dealing with this many species, it must have been difficult.
it was hard, yeah. But I remember when I first saw it in person. I mean, you can imagine it, but until you really see something you've worked on for so long, you don't really feel like it's real, you know? So that was a really great moment for me. Was, like you said, it's a big honking book. Like it's heavy. It's like I've been in situations lately where I've had to carry on four or five copies, and I'm like, it's too heavy. But seeing it, a tangible thing that brought together the work of so many different people and represents so many different species. I think, yeah, it's really wonderful to see it out in the world.
And in a sense, it's almost like, the book version of a museum. So I'd like to talk about, does it, as you described earlier, this is divided into different biomes. Talk about taking the entire world as your subject. And
Yeah.
then divvying it up into biomes. And I must say, I was extremely pleased to see cities as one of the biomes.
Yeah, I was really excited to work on the cities chapter. It was kind of the one where I most didn't know what to expect when I was going into it because urban wildlife is really a new-ish area of study. People are doing a lot of really great work, researchers in that area, and we're gaining more and more understanding of how other species are reacting to the fact that, we're building cities all over the place. And then meanwhile, we're reacting to our own city building by being like, okay, how can we like incorporate nature a little bit better into these spaces where we live and work? So yeah, tackling that chapter was especially interesting. In terms of, putting it together biome by biome, you mentioned DK books before. I definitely was thinking when I was writing about this book, like, what book did I want when I was a kid that didn't exist? I was a kid who grew up obsessed with wildlife, like always wanting to know more about animals, especially. And I remember several like holidays in a row, I would ask my parents, I would say, I want an animal encyclopedia. And they'd always get me one, but it was always not quite what I wanted, like it wasn't quite like what I was imagining. And so getting to write that book that I wanted as a kid was really fun.
That is the best reason for writing a book, is to write something that you alone want to read. That is the best guarantee that other people will want to read it as well. You're going to appear here in Santa Cruz. We're surrounded by wildlife here. And just this morning, when I was out on the beach with the dogs walking them, we saw a sea lion, we saw a dolphin, saw lots of crows. And the crows are really fascinating birds because they will let you get very close. And you can tell they're quite intelligent. Are there specific species you're going to speak about at Loud Nelson?
Yeah, absolutely. That's been something really fun about taking this book to different cities and getting to meet people is A, like it gives me an opportunity to learn a little bit more about the wildlife in each state and city. And then B, I get to hear from the people who come to the events about what's important to them. And sometimes I get tips from them, where should I go while I'm there? That's really fun. But I love California. I've been lucky enough to visit a number of times. It's such a beautiful state. And I've never been to Santa Cruz, but I am really excited to go. And I think, yeah, we're gonna get to highlight, like you said, there's so many, I think, intersecting environments with you guys. There's the ocean, there's forests, there's city. So it's gonna be fun to explore all those different environments, in a smaller area.
One of the things about the city as a biome, I've always thought, is that the idea of a division between what's natural and what's human is kind of false because, I mean, cities are essentially our version of termite mounds.
Yeah, totally.
And so I'd like to talk about how. Who's studying animals, wildlife in the cities? And it's becoming, there's a lot more of it that, animals are losing some of their fear of the cities. We have a lot of mountain lions that will walk right up into our cities these days. And that's a pretty scary experience. I mean, that's like, all right, we had not a mountain lion, but a lynx that was sitting in the tree in our backyard that's like right about, it was about 10 feet away from us because we have a big porch, and it was like way up the tree and it was looking right at us. It's a pretty amazing experience to see the wildlife in the city, especially when it comes to you.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It can be a little scary and stressful. And it's also just a reminder that we live very close together with wildlife, you know, like you said, sometimes it comes into our backyard. Even if it doesn't, the sort of natural processes that make the earth not turn, but do all the things it does, that connect all of us, right? So whenever I see an animal, like I live in the Boston area, we don't get a ton of like big mammals or anything coming into the city right now, but I'll see kestrels sometimes. I see red-tailed hawks a lot. We'll see rabbits and squirrels and stuff. And I always just think about how like, okay, this bunny is in my yard, but I'm connected to all bunnies everywhere through, you know, the water cycle and the food webs and our climate, which is obviously on everybody's minds. I think having a encounter with wildlife, whether it's on purpose or not, is an occasion to think a little bit about that too. And the point of the book was kind of to give you this feeling like you are having that connection with a different species on each page. You're learning about their life. You're learning like their needs, how they address those needs, their history, their culture in some cases. The idea is just to get across the fact that like we all kind of want the same things, you know? Animals are coming into cities because they need places to live, they need food, they need water, and they're discovering that this is a good place to get it. They're not always right about that, you know? And the fact that they make those decisions can be difficult for us, but we all are kind of on the same page in terms of like just trying to make it, you know? So it's going to be interesting to see in the future how we deal with this specific issue of wildlife coming into cities and what we do with that. I know in California, they've been doing a great job creating corridors that help large mammals like mountain lions cross over highways and avoid having to actually, you know, cross roads and run into people and go through backyards. But I'm really curious to see as we build more and more cities and as we change the earth in so many ways, what's going to follow from that. And I sort of hope that books like this and just giving people the opportunity to think a little bit more about the fact that we're not the only species on the planet might help us go in a slightly better direction than we might otherwise. Because I think, you know, we all really need each other to keep this planet the way that we're used to it being and to be a livable place, you know?
Now, this book is, in a sense, a real snapshot in time because we are losing lots of species every year, and there were many more before this. But as a snapshot in time, how long did it take you to make this snapshot?
Yeah, it totally is a snapshot in time. I thought about that a lot. You know, I'm on the wildlife beat journalistically, so I'm constantly getting papers about biodiversity crisis, the what people call the insect apocalypse, especially we're losing a lot of numbers of, we're losing entire species and we're some of which we didn't even know about before they were gone. And we're losing just by sheer numbers, a ton of wildlife at all scales. So I really felt, you know, that responsibility when I was putting together this book, like this is a chance to you know, pay tribute to all these creatures who might not be around. You know, if we don't steward the world well, they won't be around forever. But in terms of, I'm sorry. How long it took me. Sorry, I got on my soapbox and I couldn't get up. It took about 3.5 years, I think, to do this book. 3.5, 4 years. I started working on it in early 2020.
That's actually really fast. It seems to me, given the volume, sheer volume of information. Yeah. And that's one of the things I love is, you know, you go from creature to creature and type, and also including fungi and microbes. What led to that decision to include creatures that most of us cannot see with our own eyes, at least?
Totally. So I wanted to include at least a few microbes. They're not, you know, what people call charismatic, meaning like charismatic species are easy to relate to and the ones that humans tend to really love. But I love little critters. Like, I love bugs a lot. There's a ton of bugs in this book because they're sort of my special interest. But I also love microbes, and microbial life is so vital for all of us. You know, microbes were the ones who figured out how to create oxygen. Like, they're the only reason we're here. So stuff like that is really important. And I wanted to make sure that they got their due. I mean, if this book was, you know, proportional in terms of species, like if it had proportionately as many representatives from mammals and plants and birds and stuff as there are in existence, it would be like fully microbes, you know. Instead, it's the opposite. You know, we have a lot more mammals and birds because there are things that we know maybe a little bit more about and they're maybe a little bit more interesting to us. But microbes really need to get their moment in the sun as well.
Well, also, I'm glad to see that you had, and you may have people who talked about this, the Pacific football fish.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a species, one of the species that has, like, essentially a fishing pole on its forehead.
Yeah, totally.
Talk about discovering and writing about creatures that, essentially, you know, when you bring them things up from the ocean, I mean, they just shrink. They're like nothing. So talk about recreating the creature in its environment and as part of its environment rather than just saying, well, here's a picture of this thing.
Totally. Yeah, that's a great question. That's something I think about a lot. I think, as you know, a science journalist who focuses on non-human species, like, it's kind of tough because, unlike most journalists, I can't interview my subjects. I can't ask them what their experience is like. I can't ask them how they're feeling or about their memories. Like, maybe someday, but not right now. So I feel a heavy responsibility to get their lives across in a way that is truthful and then is also, you know, evocative, and to kind of bridge that gap between species experiences. And you're right. Like, a lot of times when we study creatures, especially historically, we've done it sometimes because it was the only way. We've sort of plucked them from their environment and we've either, you know, taxidermied them and studied their anatomy, or we put them in a little like terrarium and we see what they do. It's not always the best way to understand what their life is actually like. Technology is advancing, especially with undersea excursions like you're talking about. We have more and more opportunities to kind of go down beneath the ocean super deep and at least get a little bit of video footage or get a little bit of vision of what life might be like for these underwater creatures. And then the rest of it is kind of like using your imagination a little bit, I guess. Like, you gather all the information you can, and you kind of have to think to yourself, like, okay, I know that this fish lives in this place in this way. Like, can I fill in the details? Like, not like making things up, but just like what follows from that, you know? Like, one of the most interesting interviews I did for this book was with someone who studies, they're called sea skaters. They're the only insects that live in the open ocean. I didn't know that any insects lived in the open ocean. I was thrilled to hear about sea skaters. There are 7 known species of them, and they never see land. They just live their whole lives in the middle of the ocean, and they look like water striders. You know, they've got these long legs.
Wow, that's amazing. I never even thought there could be such a thing.
Right. So I think when you're a scientist studying these creatures, you have to think to yourself, okay, what's that like? Because that leads you to questions that lead to experiments or types of observations that you want to make. And I kind of try to, obviously, I try to talk to a lot of people who get to watch these creatures, or I read scientific papers or I watch videos. And then I think those same things to myself, like, what is this like? So that's how I try to approach it.
One of the really fun things of this book is to just flip through it and find things that you can't even imagine have existed. Sea striders is an excellent example. Was there some creature that whose existence you discovered that kind of like blew your mind?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the whole thing was really mind-blowing. The first one that comes to mind is this class of frogs called marsupial frogs that, you know, marsupials, traditionally they have babies in a pouch and the babies develop in that pouch and then they come out. So kangaroos are the most famous example. I didn't realize that there's a group of frogs. I think they're in South America that sort of do the same thing. They have their babies like inside the mom's pouches in the mom's skin. And you can see in photos, these frogs, they have lumps all over them, which are little eggs. And then when the eggs hatch, the baby frogs come out and they ride around on their mom for a while and then they go off. And just the image of that, you know, like, I don't know, something about seeing those pictures really made me discover for the billionth time that there's just so much out there. There's so many amazing solutions that creatures have come up with to the problem of how to stay alive and how to reproduce and how to enjoy life and be on this planet. And that was one of them that really, really shocked me for whatever reason.
One thing I've often thought, or actually not often thought, but a while back I interviewed an author about who wrote The Genius of Birds. And I, like many people before, I had always thought of birds as kind of like, you know, having no brain and just being things that flew around, not much more intelligent than insects. And once I realized how smart birds were, I started to rethink my whole vision of life on this planet. And I've read a bit of science fiction, so I also thought, you know, that the difference between us and life on this planet is as much, or that gap is as great as might be between us and alien life. And we might look at alien life and think, well, that's like just barely a rock. And it might have its own civilization. And so I'm wondering if, as you experience and studied and plunged yourself into the lives of the different creatures of this planet, if you yourself start to reevaluate, you know, our place versus their place, our intelligence versus their intelligence. I mean, animals are really quite intelligent. I mean, they manage to stay alive in places and in ways that we could never achieve.
I think sort of broadening the concept of intelligence is really a great step along the path of appreciating different creatures. Like you said, you know, like, it's easy to sort of look at something that you know, like, can't talk to you, or maybe, like, you know, can't read, and think like that means it's dumb, you know. But it's not true. Like, everything that's alive on this planet with us is smart in its own way. It has to be in order to survive. It probably plays a super important role in its ecosystem. It's having experiences, whatever that might mean to it. There are some very specific examples of that in the book that I found really interesting. There are birds in Australia called, people know them as firehawks. There are three or four different types of birds, kites mostly, and other birds of prey that have learned how to spread forest fires on their own. So this is really interesting to me. Like, we think of fire making as a really human activity, right? When we think back to our own prehistory, we think of the discovery of fire, how to make fire, as super important in our own cultural evolution. But these birds have figured out they like fires because fires chase small animals out of the underbrush that they can eat. They toss insects up into the air that they can pluck from the sky. And so they want these fires to get bigger. they like them. They want to exacerbate them, which, like, didn't used to be quite as much of a problem back when the climate change wasn't exacerbating wildfire risk in general. It used to be, you know, a fire every once in a while was good for the ecosystem. So these birds, they take flaming branches out of fires and they fly them a little ways away and they use them to set another fire. And, you know, firefighters in Australia are really annoyed by them because they make their jobs harder. But, you know, this is like a cultural bird behavior that, like, I didn't know about before I started writing this book. And there's so many examples of that. And sometimes, like, you know, if you look at something just through a slightly different lens, it becomes very apparent that there's a lot of things like that going on. And then, you know, there's even the example of, like, slime molds. There are slime molds in this book. That's the name for a large class of organism. They're single-celled, but they can think in their own way, you know? They make very logical decisions in pursuit of mostly food. So, like, researchers do experiments with them where they'll put them in like a labyrinth and they'll put a little oat flake at the middle of the labyrinth. And the slime mold figures out the labyrinth because it wants the oat flake. So it like senses where it is and it figures out how to get there in the most efficient way. Stuff like that is like, you just kind of have to, if you expand your mind, you can enjoy the world a lot more because you can realize that all of this stuff is going on around you. And if your response to that is, there's an argument that your response to that should be like, so what, right? Like it can't build an airplane. So why do I care? But if your response to that is instead, actually, that's amazing. I wonder what else it can do that I don't know about. I wonder what that is like. Then you can have sort of a richer time on Earth, I think. So that's how I prefer to look at it.
And this book is a perfect gateway to that kind of thought. One of the really crafty and interesting things you guys do is to, in each biome, weave together each species and talk about one species, then the next, then the plants, then the animals. Talk about creating a biome page by page.
Yeah, that was a super interesting part of making this as well. There are definitely some places that I developed a greater appreciation for when I realized how many of the species in the book lived in that place, you know? Like, what's a good example? Like Borneo. I hadn't ever thought too much about Borneo before, but now I really want to go because it's like one of the forest biomes we wrote about that's just so incredible. And these places, like all of the creatures in them work together to create the, the context where these amazing things happen. So I'm actually going to flip to this page to make sure I'm getting this right. it's hard to hold everything in my head at once.
But, my God, I can hardly hold half a page.
Yeah, but like in Southeast Asia, for example, they have these really, really tall trees. And because they have such tall trees, all of these animals have sort of learned to glide that wouldn't normally glide. So they have gliding flying squirrels, they have gliding lizards, snakes, frogs, like all because that's the best way to get around in a situation where you have tall, narrow trees, not necessarily a ton of branches. You end up evolving basically like paragliders that are part of your body, you know? So like just learning how all of these things kind of co-create each other was really cool.
I'm wondering if, as a writer, how did you pick and choose what you yourself wrote about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I sort of, I gave myself first dibs, kind of. Like there were a lot of things that I really wanted to cover, and so I kind of called those for myself, and then when I got the contributor pitches in, there were always things that I felt jealous of, like, oh, I wish I could cover this. But of course, I would ask them to do it and they would always do such a great job. And then at the end, there would always be gaps to fill, like I would realize, OK, we don't have enough species from Australia in this chapter. So I need to find a few more examples of that. Or, we have way too many birds and we don't have enough fish here. So I need to find a fish. So that gap filling process was always fun. I often found stuff when I was looking specifically to fill a hole that I wouldn't have necessarily found otherwise. But yeah, I was honestly I've been on this beat for so long and it was really fun. Often when you are a wildlife journalist, it's hard for me to write about a creature when there's not some reason to. Like I'm often covering new papers or there's been some new discovery made or whatever. Like there's some reason that we're talking about this species at this time. And beyond that, you don't get a chance to. But I didn't need an excuse to write about any of the creatures here, right? Like if I thought it was interesting, it was possible for me to include it. So that was really special.
One of the things that Atlas Obscura does so well is to illuminate the parts of the world and the critters of the world that we don't know so much about. Talk about making that call, and encountering things that you had never seen or knew much about, but then got to dig in. this is, I mean, were there specific areas of research that you found just particularly enjoyable or said, oh, wait, that's a rabbit hole I have got to go down?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that comes to mind quickly is this book specifically. There was a freelancer, a contributor named Christina Diosa, who pitched a piece about Sulawesi warty pigs, which live in Indonesia. And their claim to fame in the book, I mean, they're amazing creatures in their own right, but they're the subject of the world's earliest known cave paintings of figures. So there are older cave paintings of like handprints or abstract drawings, but this is the oldest like living thing that a person ever drew is these pigs. So that was super fascinating to me. And now I'm really obsessed with cave paintings. I read about them all the time. And I realize that they're such a cool way to learn about how humans in the past coexisted with all of these different creatures. You know, when I think about people making cave paintings, I feel like they're the equivalent of me today. Like they were capturing the world around them. They were trying to pay tribute in their own way to what they saw. And that's what I'm trying to do. So I feel a real connection to cave painters. And I don't know that I would have figured that out if not for learning a little bit more about this animal.
This is, I think, in a way, the closest thing to be published these days to what used to be called an encyclopedia. When I grew up, I remember my grandma had a collection of Compton's encyclopedias, and then later on we had the Life magazine made a series of books that were kind of illustrated like this. Talk about, you know, putting stuff down in print permanently versus on a website where you can update it and change it. I mean, that must be like a kind of a hard decision to make.
It's a little scary, for sure. You just have to kind of do the best you can. I felt lucky that this book, you know, had a fact checker and we had a lot of chances to check stuff. And I got to talk to a lot of different kinds of experts and feel pretty confident in what was being printed. But some of the stuff in the book, honestly, like I hate to say it, but it's already out of date, right? Like we said, you know, this is the tallest tree and it's already, you know, a taller one has been discovered. You know, this is just an area where we're learning stuff every single day. So in that sense, it is a snapshot, like you said, of a particular period of time. And as the years go by, it will be less and less correlated with the reality, but hopefully it will still remain close enough that it's like workable. And if nothing else, it will be an artifact for people in the future to see how we were thinking about things at this time.
And that I think is really important because this is a book that celebrates the joy of all the diversity of life on this earth. And I'd like you to just comment on the animating spirit of that, you know, joy in the biodiversity, which is just, you know, the scene that laid out page after page in color and beautiful photographs. There is a whole heck of a lot of beauty that just occurs naturally in this world.
I'm so glad that's what the book said to you, because that was definitely what I wanted to get across. I mean, I think like we're living in such an interesting time. Like we've changed the planet so much. You know, everybody knows about climate change and its effects and its predicted future effects. And there's also, you know, a biodiversity crisis happening at the same time, hand in hand with the climate crisis. And it's kind of it's a bit of a difficult time to really love the planet because it's so scary what's happening to it. But at the same time, you know, like I've always felt this deep connection to nature. I've always felt deeply interested in other species, and having the ability to kind of put that feeling on the page, it felt like a real privilege. And I think hopefully reading this book, hopefully getting a sense of curiosity and wonder and surprise and excitement and connection can kind of lead people to think about you know, what we can do to protect this beauty and make sure that the conditions continue to exist for it to be there. Because I think the thing that people are really doing to the world with the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis is they're making it less exciting. You know, they're making it less diverse. Some of the rare creatures in here are going to disappear. As we make environments more and more similar to each other, we will end up with less, you know, the place you can find beauty in everything, but there will be less opportunities to sort of learn about all the incredible difference that exists. So I hope that this book can help people see the importance of preserving what we still have and making sure that we can all like live together well, hopefully far into the future.
Earlier I said this book was like an encyclopedia. It's also, I think, in a sense, a kind of a zoo, where you capture specimens, but you don't hold the actual specimen. You just keep its image. And I'm wondering if there are any specific creatures in here that, you know, you yourself took photographs of or shepherded their imagery in, and then, you know, thought, well, this poor critter's, it's probably gone by the time this book is published.
Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't take any of these pictures personally. I'm not a very good photographer, unfortunately. I wish I was better. But yeah, the pictures really do so much to get across, like the immediacy of these creatures, like what they look like and what it's like to be near them. There is one animal in the book that is already extinct. I decided to include it because I thought its story was important. It's called the Bramble K. malomus. It was the first mammal to go extinct due to climate change, and it was from Australia. Its island basically got erased from sea level rise, and there are none left. So you said the book is very joyful, and I think it mostly is, but there are a few entries where those other feelings kind of come through, and that's one of them. And another one is an entry about some insects that live in the mountains in the United States that actually are some of the first insects to be listed on the endangered species list due to climate change, which is very sad for them because their prognosis is not great, but also might open a pathway to legal action being taken in order to reverse climate change, because we have a duty legally to protect animals on the endangered species list. And if the only way to protect these little glacier bugs is by doing something about climate change, there's an argument that we have to do that. So I'm always interested in when animals kind of are able to play, and plants and other species are able to play a role in the legal system and other systems that we think of as specifically human, but help shape the world.
You mentioned the insect apocalypse. And I think one of the effects of a book like this is to help us understand that things we cannot see and do not think about nonetheless cast an enormous shadow over our everyday existence. And talk about creating a book to offer that kind of message, but not as a hammer to the head.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think I'm kind of like, I care so much about this. And at the same time, I am not a polemical person, you know, like I really value people who are able to speak directly to their principles and like, you know, give incredible speeches and like rally people to their causes. But it just doesn't come naturally to me. What does come naturally to me is sharing stories and like, you know, focusing on details and being funny. And so when I thought about putting this book together, I hoped that doing that a bunch of different times in a bunch of different ways would give this overall picture of a planet that is worth caring about, and a huge, huge group, only a fraction of whom are even in these pages, of creatures who really depend on us to make good decisions in order to keep existing. So I think that was my hope.
One of the things this book does quite well is to focus on a story where humans are a narrative species. We approach things and understand them by virtue of stories and narratives. Talk about creating narratives for, you know, this book is like a giant spider web or a giant mural. You have to weave together so many things. And each story captivates us and takes, in a sense, this is also like a choose your own adventure. You might look at a spider here, and then a plant there, and fungus there, a microbe there. Talk about, you know, creating the nested narratives that drive the reader to really enjoy and understand the power of this book.
Yeah, thanks for noticing that. I think that was another thing that I thought about a lot when I was putting together the mix of creatures, was like, okay, like, you know, each of these blurbs is maybe 350 words. It's not enough to say every single thing about these creatures' lives, right? So for each, I really have to pick one thing to focus on, and I have to tell the story of that one adaptation or that one like role that it played in human history, or that one really cool thing that it does and how we figured out that it does it. So there was choice like that involved. And I think the idea is that over the course of the book, these meta narratives emerge that are a little bit more about larger themes like evolution and how evolution works, or animal and plant culture and how we can think about other species as having cultures and intelligence, like we were saying before, even if it's not something we normally think about, or, you know, change, like how animals are moving to cities and how climate change is changing environments. These themes, my hope is that they will rise out of the reading experience, even if they're not so explicitly mentioned all the time, because all these stories sort of build into them.
You're going to be hosting an event at the Loud Nelson Center on next Tuesday at 7 p.m. with Bookjob Santa Cruz. I'd like you to talk about, you know, the power of these kind of events to draw us all together. You know, we all live in our own particular biome, as you mentioned. It's where the ocean meets the forest, and there's, you know, a sliver of a city in between. Talk about traveling to different people, different cities, and trying to weave together the people in the cities, yet also, as a writer, you're trying to weave together the different cities into, you know, a picture of the globe itself.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have the opportunity to travel a little bit to talk about this book, because like you said, it's an opportunity to be in places that can be quite different from each other. Last week, I was in Philadelphia and Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, and I learned so much while I was there. I didn't realize before I went there that they had the first urban squirrels in the country, and their squirrels are actually really cool. If you pay a little bit, if you know that, then you pay a little more attention to them, and you can kind of see what makes them a little different. They have their own like little squirrel vibe going on. I don't yet know what I'm going to discover in Santa Cruz, but I'm really excited to see what it is, and I'm excited to speak to people there.
The new book by Kara Jaimo is Atlas Obscura: Wild Life and Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. Thank you for joining me, Kara.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to talk to you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.